Well, Gene, I think many would give you a standing ovation for those words you had to read. Whoa! All right, well, we are not asking for volunteers to read next Sunday right now, because that would not be good marketing. All right, well, I'd like to give everybody another opportunity just to kind of center yourself. Sometimes we hit the floor running and our mind just keeps on going even when our body stops. So I invite you to take a few deep breaths. Think with intention about those things that are running around in your mind and say, I can deal with that later. That right now I want to prepare my heart, open my heart and my ears to what might be said to me this morning. Amen. So when I first started the book of Esther, a few of our very adventurous readers read to the end of the story, and it had a very different feel than the beginning of the story. And they're like, can't wait to hear what you say about that. And that was what was read today. Last week, my message kind of got tossed. This week, as I really did a fair amount of research into that question of violence in the Older Testament, and how do we kind of pull that together with this Jesus words from the New Testament. And so actually that was going to be a learning curve for me too, because I've had some ideas about it and I've had my own ways of dealing with that, but I thought that'd be good for us. It's not the kind of sermon that you go home maybe feeling all enthused about and yeah, let's just go do that. But it's a very important one, because, Paul says, or Peter, can't remember which one, said, be ready to talk to your faith. Be ready to, to acknowledge and be able to, in a sense, justify your faith. And so what do you say when someone walks up to you and says, help me, two gods? You got this old one who seemed to really love, killing people and at times, and, slaughter them all, don't take any prisoners. And then you've got the words of Jesus. And so I was looking forward to trying bringing those two together. And I will, because a couple of who have already knew that I had detoured said, I want to hear that sermon, and so we will get to it. But I got distracted in my own way again this week by a contrast. Contrasts are a part of life, right? You got big and small, up and down, rough and smooth, fast and slow. And then there's stationary and moving. I must admit, I started out pretty much on the stationary side of life. Many of us have a Comcast or Xfinity, and on there is a button that says guide. So if you want to know what's on TV, you can push that button and it will show you. I didn't need that in my house growing up. I was a walking guide. Ask me what night Bonanza was on, I could tell you. The Fugitive, I could let you know that too. I love me some Green Acres and the Beverly Hillbillies, Mission Impossible, Combat, McHale's Navy. That was me, Petticoat Junction. I was all over that stuff. I knew Monday through Friday as well as I knew my name. But after my dad died suddenly of a heart attack, I would one day ponder his love for fried chicken and his affinity for the sedentary life. And over the course of time, then, I began to realize that I need to do something as opposed to this sedentary life. But long before that thought entered my mind, Jesus had told his apostles to get up and do something, to skedaddle. And so that brings us to a different text that I'd like to read for us this morning. And Gina always does a marvelous job, but I didn't want to throw a curve at you at the last minute. So this is found in Luke's gospel. And the little title over it says, Jesus sends out 72 messengers. So it says, after this, and we'll mention what the this is in a moment. After this, the Lord appointed 72 others and sent them out two by two ahead of him to every town and place where he was to go. He sent them out. He said to them, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out the workers into the harvest. Go. 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 I'm sending you out like lambs among the wolves. Don't take a purse or a bag or a sandal. But when you enter a house, say first to that house, peace be to this house. And if someone who promotes peace is there, your peace will rest upon them. If not, it will return to you. Stay there, eat, drink, whatever they give you, for the worker deserves his wages. Immediately following what? So that's a really important part of the story, because what precedes these words of after this was the story of three people who had come up with excuses for why they couldn't go somewhere. The first one says, well, my dad just died. That sounds like a reasonable request. He says, I got to go bury my dad. And Jesus says, let the dead bury the dead. And another one says, I'd just like to go say goodbye to my family, to which Jesus kind of gives this resounding, all-encompassing response, which is, no one who puts their hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. So you've got this resistance to following. You've got this resistance to going, and then Jesus sends his troops. 36 pairs, 72 people into the nearby villages, the villages that Jesus would be going to. It's quite a contrast, isn't it? And Jesus says to them, you need to be vulnerable. I don't want you to go in heavily resourced. I want you to get help from those who you're going to talk with. Be dependent upon their good graces so that those that you encounter will know that you are, you know, that you're human, that you're available to them. He says, but if they don't treat you well, if your peace does not fall upon them, he says, that's all right. Wipe your feet off and go on to the next village. So my take is that prior to this, the disciples and the apostles had pretty much just been watching the Jesus show. They'd been sitting on the sidelines, observing, discussing, boy, that, you know, that teaching that Jesus gave. That was a great one. This one I didn't understand so well. Or cogitating on the miracles that Jesus was doing. But Jesus says, okay, it's enough sitting. Now it's your turn to do something. So this past week as a nation, many of us were still reeling from the horrific shootings that took place. And in the midst of that, two words became a rallying cry. So following the death of the murder of the nine people in Dayton, the governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine, began to offer what seemed to be just kind of a very boilerplate speech following yet another slaughter of innocent people. But before he could get very far into that speech, a voice cried out, do something. And he continued, but then another voice joined him, do something, do something. And pretty soon there was this chorus, this cacophony, this chant of do something. And it drowned out his words. Once again, we witnessed the power of words. The chant got me to thinking about those two words are to be the rallying cry for followers of Jesus. Do something. But are they? Or maybe they should be, but they're not. Or maybe they are for some, but not for others. So thinking about that got me to thinking about a dangerous question. It's a question that every business asks itself. It's a question that every school asks itself. It's a question that every purposeful person asks of themselves. And when you are parenting your own four-year-old child, or you're grandparenting your granddaughter or grandson, four-year-old child, it's quite often one of their favorite questions, and quite honestly, it can drive us crazy. And that question is, well, before I mention that question, I'd like to have you think of another question, a question that churches do ask. And that is, what should we be doing? To what degree we actually do those things following that discussion is another matter. And that question, though, of what should we be doing, often leads to lots of exasperation. In other words, hand-wringing. What are we going to do? What are we going to do about declining attendance? What are we going to do about less visitors? What are we going to do about reduced income, reduced revenue? What are we going to do about all the things that need repairing? What are we going to do about? What are we going to do about? What are we going to do about? But lurking behind that is a more primordial question. And that's the question, why? Why do we do what we do? I think that over the years, that question has rarely been talked about in church leadership or among members. I think we just take it for granted. We assume the why, and there's some saying that goes with that. Yet almost every business asks itself the why question, and quite often it's profit, right? Bottom line, schools ask themselves the why question, and our government asks the why question, and answered it, found in the preamble to the Constitution, right? We, the people of the United States, in order to perform a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity, do ordain this Constitution for the United States of America. It might be suggested that whenever we look at the amendments that follow, we keep in mind the preamble. But for the church, this denomination, our why is found in our mission statement, right? The mission of the United Methodist Church is to, Gina knows that I know anyone else, make disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world. Good, I see a few of you lipping it. Very good. That's what's supposed to get us up out of bed in the morning. That's what's supposed to put a skip in our step. That's supposed to be our cup of morning joe. When the disciples were sent out by Jesus, it was clear they were the advance team. They were going to go ahead, prepare the way for the good news of Jesus. Jesus was coming. And they were out there with a unified voice, because they were unified in the why. But would I be too far off in thinking or saying that in most churches, most Methodist churches, we don't know our mission statement? And even if we can mouth it, even if we can say it, it's really not baked into our local DNA. It's really not lived out as a part of our guiding principle. So this past week, I was able to go to the Global Leadership Summit. And Craig Rochelle was the speaker there. And he kind of laid out the format for us. And this was one of his mantras in his opening talk. He said, if you commit to the what and are consumed by your why, you will figure out the how. You know, as I thought about that, I thought, churches, we spend so much of our time on the what and the how. But really, I think Craig nailed it when he said, well, the gasoline that strikes the engine is the why. To be reminded of the why. As much as the persistent asking why by the four-year-old at times might drive us crazy, there's something to learn from them. The why is so important. The why is the guiding light. The why is what aligns the stars. So Patrick Lencioni, one of my favorite speakers at the Global Summit. This time he took a different approach. He said there are five things that poor leaders avoid doing, kind of a whole bunch of negatives there. And the fifth one that he mentioned was a poor leader will avoid repeating themselves. I thought, oh, God bless you. I don't want to be a poor leader. So let me repeat myself then, so if I may. John Wesley, the founder of our church, he had his why in spades. After decades of religious activity, he had a life-changing, soul-transforming encounter with God. He'd had religion and religious activity up to his eyeballs, and what had it gotten him? Now, the preacherly type answer you might think is, oh, he must mean nothing. No. Contraire. It got him something. It had gotten him a life where he felt unworthy, undeserving of the love of God. And so what did he do? More religious things. More religious activity. Hoping that he could tip the balance in his favor. But in the end, it was never enough. In the end, it would be, as someone read Martin Luther's preface to the Book of Romans. Now, that doesn't really sound like energizing bedtime beach reading to me. But as Luther's preface to the Book of Romans was read, Wesley said he felt his heart strangely warmed. He would write, I felt I did trust Christ and Christ alone for my salvation. And from there then would spring two powerful themes for his life. First, there was this intense sense of the presence of God in his life. And his desire was for the whole world to come to experience the love and forgiveness of God as he had. So I think it's a fair question whether you're a Methodist or whether you're a Christ follower. You know, have you had that sense? You know, have you entered into that kind of a, well, not only is it up here, but it's in here. I remember Dr. Byrne, my Christian education professor in seminary, said that the longest 12 inches in the world is from your head to your heart. That, you know, good old Bull Byrne, that was our nickname for him. I always remembered that statement of his. It's good to have it up here, you know, but we need it here as well. So is that your experience? And the second theme of Wesley's life was this intense drive to make the world a better place, especially for those who were deemed or treated as the less thans of society. Ever since, when those two qualities have been present, we've seen the strength and the genius of the Methodist Church become an all-consuming experience with God because of the why. But it's hard to keep those two in balance, and so often wants to swing one way or the other. The unabashed commitment to social justice has been the what. And when those two things come together, as Craig says, the how gets figured out. Interestingly enough, Wesley was concerned that one day the why might get lost in the midst of all the religious activity. So he records these words, "I am not afraid that the people called Methodists should ever cease to exist, but I am afraid lest they should only exist as a dead sect, having the form of religion without the power." That's the why. And this undoubtedly will be the case unless they hold fast to the doctrine, spirit, and discipline with which they first set out. So going into the future, the church that has a vibrant future or a future at all will be those churches that, because they have a unified why, they can and will enthusiastically and collectively embrace the what to accomplish the how that gets done. The how will fall into place. And I know that's a lot of words there. So in other words, I'm thinking there needs to be a strong, heartfelt experience with God, coupled with a unified sense of how that works out in the world. And then when those things come together, mighty things can take place. To try and show that they weren't going to let hate win, a local group started the El Paso 22 Challenge. Maybe some of you have seen it. A local group committed to doing and showing that love wins. The idea was that they were challenging people to doing 22 good deeds. So Denise Contreras and her 7-year-old granddaughter embraced the challenge. 22 good deeds was one for every victim who died at the hands of the white supremacist August 3rd inside the Walmart. Oh, so Denise and the mom and her daughter began to think, what can we do? Well, one thing they did was they passed out packages of microwave popcorn that contained promotional codes that you could then take your code and go to the red box and rent a movie, and so they were giving you a movie and popcorn. On it, an accompanying note said, "Love wins." At the bottom of everything they handed out was a statement that said, "This is in memory of the 22 El Paso angels." Contreras and her daughter also made up snack bags for police officers stationed outside the Walmart where the shooting had occurred. In another location, they handed out lollipops. Another time, they taped sticks of extra gum onto index cards, and that's the picture you see there. And the message said, "Have a great day." Contreras said her daughter was having so much fun, she said, "Can we keep doing this? This is a lot of fun." They distributed water bottles to the homeless people, gave them goodie bags filled with chips, pretzels, and other snacks. They also distributed index cards with a few dollars attached to it so they might be able to buy a soda or a cup of coffee. And yet to a nursing home, they took a platter of cookies and walked around and distributed them. Remember, each item they had a note containing the name of one of the people who'd been shot. Yet another girl is collecting 22 stuffed animals to distribute to those who are still trying to cope with the tragedy of last week. Nike said, "Just do it." Jesus said, "Get up and go." "Go into all the world." John Wesley said, "The world is my parish." What will you do? Do something. Wesley also said this, "Do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the ways you can, in all the places you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, for as long as you can." What will you do? Let's pause just for a moment and see if that lands somewhere with you. What can you do? What will you do? Where's the still small voice of the Spirit stirring within you? Speak to us, Lord, for your servants desire to hear. Amen. All right, our ushers will come forward.